Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome today students from Lincoln High School. Would those students please stand? Good. Well, welcome, and please be seated. And we have students from Barneveld High School. Would those students please stand? And welcome to you, too. Please be seated. Students are here with us today with a program that is a national award-winning program. It's sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And we invite high school students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. The students have been given briefs. They have prepared for the oral argument, as have counsel and the court. And as part of their program with court with class, they will meet with a justice at the end of the second oral argument today. So we've met you. Let us introduce the court to you. At my far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the judge with whom you'll meet at about noon today. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Brooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, we are going to call our first case for this morning, 02-2781-CR, State v. John Carpru. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Alan Lee. And I apologize to all of you on behalf of the court because we are in the process of changing our... Yes, well, I'm stalling for you, Mr. Lee. We're in the process of changing our sound system, and therefore we are using a lapel microphone and... it's being amplified, but it doesn't always work very well, so someone from the court might interrupt and say, we can't hear you, at which point you're going to have to move that lapel mic farther up. Okay.
Thank you.
It's yours, Mr. Lee.
Thank you. May it please the court. The state is asking the court to reverse a court of appeals decision which held that Johnny Carpru was denied his due process rights because of the trial court's questioning of a witness outside the presence of the jury. The court held that that may have led the prosecutor to ask the same witness similar questions on rebuttal when the jury returned. It is the state's position that the trial court's actions were not error, and in the alternative, if there was any error at trial, it was harmless error. Johnny Carpru was charged with second-degree sexual assault. During the state's case, there was testimony that when the police arrived to arrest him, within hours of the assault, I might add, he ran from a second-floor apartment down the back stairs, through the basement, crawled through a window in the basement, and hid underneath a porch. When Carpru testified, he first of all claimed that the sexual contact was consensual. And he explained that he ran and hid not because he felt guilty about the sexual assault, but that he thought the police were coming to arrest him for violating conditions of bail. He was out on bail on a criminal traffic violation. After Carpru testified, the trial court questioned Kenneth Morrow, the head of in-house correctional services, which is the program that was monitoring Johnny Carpru and monitors others in Milwaukee County for conditions of bail. The jury was not present. the state called Kenneth Morrow as a rebuttal witness. And he repeated much of the same information that he had given outside of the presence of the jury when the jury was present for rebuttal testimony. Carpru does not claim, and the Court of Appeals did not hold, that the prosecutor's questions were objectionable or that the rebuttal evidence wasn't relevant. In other words, there is no claim that the evidence brought out on rebuttal was not accurate or was in any way objectionable. And, of course, there was no objection at the time. Rather, according to the Court of Appeals, the error was that the judge's questions may have suggested a line of questioning that the prosecutor might not have otherwise pursued. The Court of Appeals described the trial court as a, quote, hinting advocate for the prosecution. That conclusion is not supported by the record, as we point out in our brief, and it is not a correct application of law. Under this court's precedence, the issue is whether the judge's questions improperly influenced the jury to the detriment of the defendant.
That's the test.
Yes, I believe so. Here, the jury never heard the judge's questions, never knew that the judge questioned Kenneth Morrow at all. And even if the judge's questions suggested a line of questioning to the prosecution, that is not error. Judges are allowed to question witnesses. That's undisputed. If the questions asked by the prosecutor were proper and the evidence was relevant, it is immaterial who, if anyone, suggested a line of questioning to the prosecutor. Questions might be suggested by a prosecutor's colleague. Maybe a courtroom observer might suggest a line of questioning to one of the lawyers. Or a judge might suggest.
What's the difference between some observer or a police officer who's involved in the case is just different than the judge. The judge is supposed to be a neutral, right?
The fact that the judge suggests a line of questioning or a prosecutor takes from a judge's questioning a line of questioning doesn't mean.
But we agree that the judge is supposed to be a neutral.
Oh, absolutely.
The judge is not running each case, either side of the case.
No.
Okay. We agree on that. So, but the judge can ask questions, and the goal is that the justice prevail.
Yes.
And if we push that, maybe that the truth be out, right?
Also part of justice, yes.
Okay. So where do you draw the line between the judge moving over and sitting on one side of the case versus another? And this is a very sensitive area. We've got judges who have been in private practice or government practice. Some of them will have come from prosecution, others from defense, right?
Correct.
That's prior city attorneys and other government officers who may or may not have a natural, if not inclination, at least familiarity with it so that they can figure out what the attorney might have done, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how do we get from where do we draw that line so that the judge remains a neutral, yet is also in charge of the case, moderates the case, makes sure that justice is done?
I think, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that first of all, I have to point out here that the fact finder could not have been prejudiced by any of these questions. That seems to be undisputed.
Okay, that's good. It's not before the jury. So would you have a different kind of rule for judge cases and where it's outside the presence of the jury?
I think then we have to look at a line of cases that talk about bias and prejudice, lack of impartiality by the judge.
You're looking at the judge.
Yes. And the test there in Wisconsin is, I believe, the defendant. First of all, there's a presumption that the trial judge, any judge, is acting impartially. That's a legal presumption. Secondly, the defendant has to show, I believe, by a preponderance of the evidence, that there is actual prejudice. The cases from this court make it clear that the appearance or suggestion of partiality is not sufficient to prove that a judge is biased or prejudiced. And I think that's the line of analysis that we would have to employ if that were the question.
Now, the line of questioning here, and of course, Judge Schellinger asked a question relating to the practice of this in-house correctional facility. But you make the point that this line of questioning had been broached already by the prosecution. In other words, they were on the track or had that in their sights or were explicitly interested in those practices. Now, how can you say, and I don't disagree with that, but then you say, well, they didn't have to list this as a rebuttal witness, which I also agree with, but the line of questioning after the judge asked it outside of the presence of the jury, and then the prosecutor banged the first, the questions were almost on track, they said.
Yes.
You don't see any problem with that?
No, I don't, for two reasons. First, it's clear from looking at the prosecutor's cross-examination of Johnny Carpru that he had the same questions about what Carpru thought was going on with in-house correctional services as the trial judge did and ultimately was straightened out by Kenneth Morrow's testimony. He was trying to get Johnny Carpru to tell the truth and say, I knew they weren't coming at me for the bail violation.
Counsel, I just want to interrupt. Does it make any difference whether Mr. Morrow was just sitting out in the audience or whether he was sequestered? There's a little debate on that, I see, between the prosecution or the state and the defense briefs.
The transcript, at one point, the judge says, and this is outside the presence of the jury, something to the effect that Kenneth Morrow had told the defense and prosecution in the judge's presence something about the records or something. So that is what I draw the conclusion from, that he was there. Also, the transcript doesn't show that there was any delay in the trial whatsoever, and he was listed as a defense witness.
He was listed, right.
That's my conclusion. It's not absolutely clear, you're right.
Does it make any difference?
To answer that question, it does not.
Mr. Lee, let me ask you a couple of questions. Do you view this case as a due process case? Is that the way we should approach it? Or do you view this case as a case concerning the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel? From the comments you were making earlier, I'm somewhat unsure of what your position is.
It can be approached either way. Certainly because...
How are you approaching it?
Well, I think the correct approach is, as Judge Fine said in his dissent, and that is that this should be an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and the burden should be on the defendant to show deficient performance and prejudice from any error. There are some cases that seem to say that you can do a straight due process analysis even though there has been no objection. Those cases, however, come up in the question generally of whether a judge should have recused himself or herself. I'm thinking of State versus Sinks, I believe it is, and maybe McBride.
Well, the cases that you referred to earlier and that are in your brief concerning prior decisions of this court in regard to judges questioning witnesses, were those cases basically due process cases?
They were. Yes, I'm not aware of any of those being ineffective assistance of counsel cases.
Given that, I'm somewhat unsure as to why you agree with Judge Fine that this should be approached as ineffective assistance of counsel. Maybe you can clear that up for me.
I think the other cases just weren't approached that way at all. There was no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel and apparently no claim of waiver. Some of those, I believe, did come up under the rubric of recusal, which would make a difference because there you're asking a court to remove or the judge to remove himself or herself from the whole trial, and there's no particular place that you would object. Sometimes the court has analyzed at least the lack of partiality or bias cases without a question of waiver appearing because I believe under the theory that if there's a a partial biased judge, you've been denied due process, and that's the end of the analysis right there from the get-go at the beginning of the trial. But the Karpru has raised this as a due process challenge, specifically targeting the questioning by the judge and the rebuttal testimony by the prosecution. That's certainly how the majority at the Court of Appeals approached the case, I think.
Counselor, just for example, let's say that the prosecutor would not have asked any of these questions. For whatever reason, it wasn't on his mind and he wasn't going to do any of this. Would it affect your analysis of the case at all?
No, because I think it's absolutely immaterial who suggested a line of questioning, as long as the questioning itself that the jury heard was relevant, not objectionable, not unduly prejudicial, whatever test you want to use.
Does that depend upon the fact that the judge did this outside the presence of the jury, or would your answer be the same if the judge had done this questioning in the presence of the jury?
I do not think it would have been reversible error at all for the judge to question Kenneth Morrow as she did in front of the jury.
Even if the prosecution had none of those questions in mind. So to you it doesn't matter whether
Correct.
It's in front of the jury or not, and it doesn't matter whether the prosecutor would have ever asked the questions or
Correct.
Not.
I believe her questions of Kenneth Morrow are very clearly clarification-type questions. The record reflects that there were questions back and forth earlier in the trial about what exactly in-house correctional services was, whether it was bracelet monitoring, et cetera. It appears that the judge and defense counsel and prosecution all at one point thought it was something that it wasn't. They then straightened that out essentially by stipulation at trial, and then Kenneth Morrow came to the stand to testify.
But were there any questions about what happens when someone violates the terms of in-house and then law enforcement is proceeding? Because that's really her line of questioning, though it involved the same general subject matter. I didn't think it involved those kinds of questions that had been asked about in-house in the past.
Right, and I think what the judge wanted to do is make sure that the actual procedures of in-house correctional services were correctly understood. She specifically said that she wasn't claiming that Johnny Karpru didn't misunderstand those and in good faith thought that the cops were coming to arrest him for bail violation. She specifically said that. That's separate from what in-house correctional services procedures actually are. What Johnny Karpru thought might very well have been what he testified to. And in that case, that might explain his flight. Again, a question of credibility for the jury, but I think the judge could have asked those questions. Her questions of Johnny Karpru, I think, would have been prejudicial in front of the jury, certainly.
Counsel, in response to Justice Robinsack, you indicate in part that your answer makes no difference if before a jury or not before a jury. And yet the way that you stated the threshold issue started with, did judges question improperly influence the jury? And the chief asked, is that the standard or is that the issue? So let me pin that down. What is your position with regard to the import in this analysis of whether or not it was before the jury that the or not before the jury that the questioning took place?
My point is that even if the judge had asked the questions that she asked of Kenneth Morrow in front of the jury, you would not be able to conclude that those questions improperly influenced the jury. They were clarification questions. They weren't adversarial.
Fair enough. Let me then go back to your issue, perhaps, and take issue with your issue. Do you mean by advancing the issue, did the judge's questions improperly influence the jury as the standard, that a judge can ask any question they want if it's not before a jury and not implicate due process?
I think at some point the judge would exhibit bias and prejudice, and you would use that analysis, yes.
So a judge's questions can be deemed improper, or that is, as infringing upon due process rights, even though a jury is not present. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so here you have, I don't know why you have the question, did the judge's Did judge's question improperly influence the jury? Why isn't your question more tailored to did the judge's questions deny the defendant his fair right to a trial?
We were the respondent in the Court of Appeals, and that is how I believe the question was put to the Court of Appeals, is whether the judge was essentially a, quote, hinting advocate for the state. That is what we responded to. That is what the Court of Appeals discussed. I think there may very well be a question of whether this should be analyzed as whether the judge was impartial or biased, but that's not the way it has been presented. And if that is the analysis, then we look at the McBride case and the Sinks case. And the defendant must prove by preponderance of the evidence that the judge was actually biased.
Does that affect whether a harmless error analysis is applied?
I think if they prove actual bias, that's the end of the analysis. Then there's
structural error.
Correct.
If you were sitting up here, Mr. Lee, I'm assuming that you would reverse the Court of Appeals, but if you were writing the opinion, what would you say about the judge's conduct here?
I think the judge's conduct was not advisable, certainly in questioning Carpru, and timing was less than ideal.
Do you talk to your kids that way?
They think I do. I'm always gentle with them. This is not a course of conduct that I think that either the state or the bench would recommend to trial court judges. And I'm talking mostly about the questioning of Johnny Carpru now. But the questioning of Morrow is relatively innocuous. There was some confusion of what in-house correctional services did and what their rules were, and the judge is certainly within his or her bounds to call a witness and try to straighten that out. The statute specifically allows a judge to call a witness. It doesn't say that it's listed to clarification, actually. I think an admonishment to the trial courts to be careful when they question witnesses under 906-14 is certainly in order. But that's a whole different question than whether this was reversible error in this case. And I think that's where...
What was their error?
In questioning Johnny Carpru, yes, I think so.
In questioning Carpru or questioning Morrow?
Not in questioning Morrow.
Okay, so you think there's error for the judge in questioning Carpru?
Yeah, and I think the trial court post-conviction decision, I think, hit the nail on the head there. There was nothing improper in the questions of Johnny Carpru. But the timing, it should have been done at sentencing, assuming he had been convicted. Those are the kind of questions that should have been asked later, not then.
That wasn't part of this case in the sense that the Court of Appeals based their decision on the
correct
questioning of Morrow.
That is correct, and that again goes to my point that what they were looking at was the hinting advocate theory, not a theory of general bias or prejudice.
Now, When I looked over the record, the state had challenged the defendant's explanation for fleeing, at least I can say several times throughout the trial. So is that a correct?
They challenged it when Carpru testified. That was their only real opportunity to do that because that's when it first came up. And in closing. And I think this also goes to the harmless error analysis. The state, in closing, mentioned it in passing. So did the defense. It was not a big part of the trial. It's the big part, the whole part of the case on appeal. But at trial, it was a very small part of the case.
Now, the defense didn't rest until after the questioning of Judge Schellinger. The witness, but they hadn't called this witness either who was on their list. Were they intending to call this witness?
No, the record's clear that they had one witness and it was Johnny Carpru, and
okay.
Everybody knew when he was done, was done.
So even though the person was on the defense witness list, the judge at least knew that they weren't intending to call call this person.
Correct. I believe the record shows that there was a colloquy among counsel in the court, and they said, we have one witness, and it was going to be the defendant because they went through the usual colloquy about his rights. I would point out, since my time is waning here, that this is a sliding kind of scale, I think. Here we had a judge who questioned a witness outside the presence of the jury. It isn't very different from a trial court in chambers with everybody there saying, you know, I don't think the jury understands in-house correctional procedures. I think there's great confusion there. And the prosecutor responding, I can take care of that in rebuttal. Certainly no one would claim that that was unfair. Or if the judge said something to the defense about, I'm not sure they understand such and such, and the defendant's lawyer said, well, I can take care of that in my next witness. That is the kind of thing that happens in trials. A colleague might come up and say, I think it's a mess with in-house correctional services. Why don't you do such and such? It doesn't mean that the judge is biased. It means the judge is trying to get the trial information to the jury so that the jury isn't confused. And I think that's what Judge Schellinger was doing here. In fact, I would point out that it's not much different from an appellate court suggesting to parties who have briefed the case that there's an issue they've missed, and the court would like further briefing and maybe argument on an issue not raised by either party. Now, that issue might very well benefit one of the parties greatly, but that doesn't mean the appellate court is biased. And I would point out also, back to Justice Crook's question, that this is, I believe, correctly analyzed as an ineffective assistance to counsel claim.
Is the basis for your argument because there was no objection made, therefore it's not due process but ineffective assistance
yes.
of counsel? Is that the linchpin of why
yes.
you see it?
And one of the problems there, of course, is we don't now have a record where the prosecutor could say, I've already talked to Morrow. In fact, Morrow was the one who suggested I call him to the stand. I wasn't even listening when the judge was questioning him. I had talked to Morrow before that, and we had decided to call. That's very possible here. But on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim and the claim that counsel should have objected, it has never been articulated exactly what this objection would have been. The judge was within her rights to call Kenneth Morrow and to question him. There's no doubt about that. The questions asked by the prosecutor were not objectionable. There doesn't seem to be any argument about that. The information was relevant. It was accurate. It informed the jury of something that seemed to be somewhat in debate. And if questions are relevant and the information is accurate and there's no objection, how can there be error?
Well, but then why did you answer to Justice Prosser when he said, how would you write the opinion? Your response was that the judge's conduct was not advisable.
Well, I think we have to draw a distinction, at least somewhat, between her questioning of Kenneth Morrow and her questioning of Carpru. I don't see anything wrong. I see no error in questioning Kenneth Morrow.
Yeah, well, let's draw the line between error.
Okay.
You've got error, and then you might say it's harmless.
Correct.
Okay, but your position here...
Error and what?
Harmless. Right?
Correct.
But your position here is tomorrow is there is no error.
Correct.
So you don't have to do harmless. And if I understand you, do you think it was advisable or wasn't advisable?
In retrospect, I suppose we all would wish that she hadn't done it. I think it was a very small part of the trial. But advisable? I think it's a decision that the trial judge has to make at the time.
Reviewable?
He or she is much better situated than we are to determine how confused things were back then, back there. We would ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Scrapkin, assistant attorney at law, representing Johnny Carpru.
Well, I passed the first test, turning on the mic. May it please the Court. The crux of the matter before this Court here today is the fact that a trial judge, a former prosecutor, told this prosecutor in the trial how to effectively impeach and convict Mr. Johnny Carpru. We don't need two prosecutors, one on the bench and one at counsel's table. We need a fair and impartial judge conducting a trial free from suspicion of partiality. This was a trial. It was not a trial advocacy course being taught in a law school.
All right, counsel. Having said that, I think that there are many cases, many you cited, that courts do ask questions. And what questions did the dealing with moral were out of bounds or inappropriate for a judge to ask?
I think the entire line of questioning, the entire action of Judge Schellinger was out of bounds.
Well, out of bounds, I was looking at the Hickman case that you cited in your brief on page 7, and you left off, I note, because the Hickman case, U.S. versus Hickman, 592 Federal 2nd, it's a Sixth Circuit case that was cited by the majority, which sided with you in the majority of the Court of Appeals, and they said, well, look, there are three instances suggesting where the trial court has a good reason to interject questions into a trial. And you, in page 7, you cite that, but you leave off number 3, which is when a witness is, one, difficult, confused, or providing unbelievable information. Now, if the court had heard this colloquy between the state, I'm talking about when the state cross-examined your client, and this issue of just what the procedure was, and you had called this witness, what questions did she ask that were inappropriate?
I think you've just made the distinction for me in that
she
called the witness as opposed to another party or participant, one of the trial advocates, calling the witness and allowing them to develop the line of questioning before she then determined that there was confusion here or the witness was not.
In the transcript, there are, and I said several, and there may not be, but at least there were what I thought several questions that the state had raised this very issue, and I asked opposing counsel whether or not they had challenged your client's explanation for fleeing throughout the trial. So this was done outside of the presence of the jury, correct?
Correct.
So the jury never knew that the judge had participated. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. The cases, and I cited Hickman, and then there's the Asperger's case and the Garner case and the Bullock case and the Schultz case. These are in the state of Wisconsin, where judges have participated. What did this judge do that was different than in those other courts where the verdicts were upheld?
This judge called a witness to the stand on her own. And
is there something, I mean, that this statute 90614 allows for that?
It does, and it allows for that in the exceptional circumstance.
Well, that's a notation taken from the Judicial Council, but not in the case law. A judge may call a witness.
That's correct.
To what? To who is, it, was there any confusion in this case about that testimony?
I don't believe that there was any confusion going on that required her to do this. I believe that the only purpose that she did this for was to assist the district attorney and provide him with a blueprint to handle the trial, to impeach and cross-examine Mr. Carpru.
Was the testimony Mr. Morrow gave, was that correct testimony? Was it something that was inaccurate?
I don't believe that there was anything inaccurate about Mr. Morrow's testimony, no.
So you're saying that it's just the presence of the judge who is a, quote, neutral magistrate asking questions which would be harmful to your client?
She went and tracked down a witness and brought him to the courtroom.
Wasn't the witness on your witness list?
I believe that the witness was on trial counsel's witness list.
So Mr. Morrow was there because he had been named as a witness by the defendant, right?
I don't believe that he was in the courtroom because the state, at the beginning of the trial, asked for all witnesses to be sequestered.
I asked the state that question. So does it make a difference whether Mr. Morrow was sitting in a room adjacent to the courtroom or in the courtroom?
I don't believe that it makes a difference whether he was there or not. I think that it gives a clue of the impropriety of what Judge Schellinger did.
You mentioned her background, that she was a prosecutor. Is that what you're... I mean, you said a former prosecutor, the judge. Did I misread that?
No.
Okay. So is that a something that shouldn't be? That? No, I'm just asking.
No. But I think that...
But you wanted us to know that she was a former prosecutor. I didn't know it until you mentioned it.
Okay. I think that indicates that she has perhaps an alliance or an affinity towards the prosecution, that she has had experience in this type of matters before, and that's what enabled her or allowed her to feel comfortable with doing what she did.
You say she called this witness,
mm-hmm.
not before the jury.
Correct.
We're talking about Morrow. Calls him in chambers. Was that recorded? Her questioning of Morrow, was it on the record?
It was on the record.
Okay, it was on the record. And, but not before the jury.
Correct.
So what's your basis for saying it's improper? Is obviously the jury is not influenced by the judge asking the questions. The jury is or may be influenced by the testimony, right?
Correct.
Because the whole point of this testimony is to attack your client's credibility.
Correct.
Thus, if he thinks he raped somebody, then he's running because he thinks they're after him for rape. If he thinks they're after him for violating a rule, then this shows that he wouldn't think they'd be after him for that, right? That's what this testimony is about. So it goes to his credibility, and his credibility is a major issue in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's harmful to him in the sense that it attacks his credibility. Why is it harmful to him that the judge here moved in on this testimony before the prosecutor did?
Because judges should not cross that line of impartiality.
Okay,
because judges should not provide a blueprint, or the Court of Appeals took a little lesser version and said it had become a hinting advocate for one side or the other.
So you think it shows she's not neutral?
Correct.
And that's your argument?
That's correct.
And that her neutrality doesn't matter whether there's a jury or not?
Absolutely.
You have a right to an impartial judge.
That's correct, whether it's a bench trial or a jury trial.
Why didn't he waive it? Because he didn't object. Counsel's there, right, in chambers. Counsel knows what the judge is going to do. Counsel hears the testimony, right?
Right.
Sees it being recorded for the record. And assume that the state's going to go in and use it. All right. So why isn't all this waived by failure to object?
Well, I think that it's not waived because I would argue that the issue becomes one of an interest of justice matter. And two, then if it is waived, is the argument that it was ineffective assistance of counsel.
But then you've got the burden to show, one, it's ineffective, but more importantly, you've got the burden to show that it's prejudicial. Right?
Correct.
Under that. So what's prejudicial? I mean, the evidence is prejudicial, using harmful to the defendant.
I think it's prejudicial for a court to take such an active and participant role in a trial.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There were actions here by the court that indicated that the court was almost acting as a party to the court. Besides calling Mr. Morrow, besides obtaining the file from the clerk's office of the defendant's previous conviction, reviewing that file, finding a letter, questioning the defendant about the letter, the trial court also took the time to certify as an expert witness the nurse who examined Ms. Bercy. The trial court did not allow a prosecutor, an exceedingly experienced prosecutor, who's handled hundreds of these cases and is the head of the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Sexual Assault Unit, to try the case on his own.
Counsel, I asked you about 90614 before. It's entitled Calling an Interrogation of Witnesses by a Judge.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at a short part here. It has three parts. One, it says a judge may, on his own motion or at the suggestion of a party, call a witness, and all parties are entitled to cross-examine. Was there any cross-examination here?
Yes.
Was there any objection at the time the judge called?
No.
So neither party objected.
Correct.
The second part of the statute says the judge may interrogate witnesses, whether called by the judge or by a party.
Correct.
And the third part is objections to calling of witnesses by the judge or to interrogation by the judge may be made at that time or at the next available opportunity when the jury is not present. Now, this is assuming that there was a jury present. Now, here there wasn't a jury present. You made issue of, well, this was a hinting advocate, or that's what the Court of Appeals said. Is it not true that in rebuttal, the state wouldn't mention, why wouldn't they have called Mr. Morrow as a rebuttal witness?
I don't know. I can't speculate as to what the state would or would not have done.
Well, where they've already had questions and answers by the defendant on this very point, wouldn't they likely or wouldn't they have called Morrow since he was, as you stated, in the vicinity of the courtroom or shortly outside or in the...
They might have called Mr. Morrow, or they might have actually called the in-house agent who is assigned to Mr. Carpru and who is actually the person who sat down with Mr. Carpru and reviewed whatever rules and regulations of in-house there were. But I can only, again, speculate as to what was going on in the assistant district attorney's mind. I can't.
But we know this much, that the defendant had Mr. Morrow there because he was on their list.
Correct.
Either in or outside of the courtroom.
Correct.
Counsel, you advanced the premise that the judge here was inappropriately, actively engaging and trying the case.
Mm-hmm.
This court, or the Wisconsin Supreme Court, has, and the Court of Appeals, have on prior occasions dealt with similar charges, and there seems to be here at least an argument as to whether or not the judge was trying the case. I think in prior cases, I think of maybe the Gardner case, the behavior perhaps is more pronounced. Now I'm going to start sounding like your opposing counsel. It might have even been more inadvisable, and I say fondly. But those courts didn't reverse the conviction. You know, we've got a long line of cases that discuss behavior that may have or did cross the line, but we never come in for the punch. So why should this court come in for the punch on these facts?
Gardner was an interesting case in that it was a revocation hearing, and my understanding of reading the case is, and this is before my time, but back then they were conducted by the courts. There weren't prosecutors or defense attorneys. And so consequently, in Garner, there was no other counsel. There was just the court conducting that hearing. How do you come? I guess I would submit to the court, there's this court's decision in State versus Giles that talks about a court not permitting itself to become a witness or an advocate for the parties. And in that case, it dealt with an evidentiary hearing that clearly was not before the jury, but that the judge then took over the role of the prosecutor and usurped the function of the prosecutor, denying the defendant a fair and impartial trial, or a fair and impartial, excuse me, evidentiary hearing in that matter. Did that answer your question?
Well,
coming in for the punch?
Facts in Giles were a little more extreme than the facts here, because the fact finder was the judge alone, and the judge was offering the evidence, in effect, through his own testimony. A little bit different here. I want to ask you, as I understand it, the trial court here asked some questions of the defendant, and that one could interpret those questions as showing some bias by the court. If there had been no questions of Mr. Morrow and only questions of the defendant, would you have enough on that to reverse the conviction?
I think that the court's actions have to be taken in the whole context of the trial. And the certification, the 10 pages of questioning to certify the nurse as an expert witness by the court, along with, and we omit Morrow here for your question, along with what she did to Mr. Carpru, are certainly sufficient to indicate a bias on behalf of the court, prejudice emanating from the court. Yes, I guess my answer is yes, that there certainly is enough to show that Mr. Carpru did not receive a fair and impartial trial.
What questioning was in front of the jury? Any of this?
No, none of this was in front of the jury.
That's right. So you have to rely on not having the jury influenced as such.
Correct.
Are you able to win here without establishing any prejudice in front of the jury?
Yes, I believe so. I believe that all defendants are entitled to a fair and impartial judge, even if the judge is just the trier of law and not the trier of fact. I believe that that's what due process means. And it doesn't matter whether a jury was influenced or biased by something that occurred in the court. We get both an impartial trier of fact and an impartial trier of law under the Constitution.
Suppose the trial judge had said to counsel, would you approach the bench, and then had asked in a quiet voice the district attorney, are you going to call Mr. Morrow? Would that have crossed the line and created the result that you're...
Probably not that alone would have crossed the line. I think that it would take a little more than a judge just asking, what witnesses are you intending to call?
Would you approach the bench, Mr. District Attorney, or Madam District Attorney, are you going to call Mr. Morrow about the procedures that they follow in that... center?
Well, now we're crossing that line a little bit more here. I honestly don't believe that would have done it either. Again, you have to look at the entire context of what happened in this trial, and that it was more than just providing that hint, perhaps you might want to call him. It was the fact that she actually went through a litany of questions, providing an absolute blueprint for the prosecutor. It was the fact that she took control of the trial.
Counsel,
but it would still have been a hinting advocate.
A hinting advocate, yes, and I'm alleging it was a blueprint more than a hinting advocate.
So, so a hinting advocate is one that corrects inconsistencies?
What is perhaps. I'm not sure that a court's responsibility...
Is the word hinting advocate, where did that come from?
The Court of Appeals majority decision.
I understand
decision.
That, but where did they get that from?
They came up with that term on their own. I believe that
I
used the term.
That was just their term.
That was their term.
Now, the when I was reading the record, the record says, at least I'm going to read that, this is what Judge Schellinger said, that the court really never gets involved in the examination of witnesses, particularly in front of a jury, but there have been things said by the defendant which are inconsistent with the way in-house operates. All right. Is that wrong for her to say that? In other words, this is outside of the presence of the jury? If a judge knows a fact, and this is a search for the truth, is a judge and the person is there, is the judge restricted from calling that person?
I think the better practice would be to have counsel do it and not allow the court to do it. Yes.
All right. If the court says, I'm not commenting on whether the defendant has been truthful or whatever his understanding is different than that which is the case, the judge said that.
Yes.
And so the information that was provided here, All you're objecting to is that the judge called this person instead of letting the state do it.
Yes.
So if the state had elicited this, so a judge can't call a witness and ask questions before giving all parties an opportunity to do so.
That would be the rule that I would like to see in place. And I think that...
Is that the rule that these other cases that have been mentioned by my colleagues up here... Is that the rule that in Asfor or in Garner or in Schultz or the other cases that you mentioned, is that what happened in those cases? If one were to follow the law, is that what happened in those cases?
Those cases were about clarification purposes.
What here wasn't about clarification or clearing up confusion or, as Hickman indicates, this was... cited by the majority that was not providing unbelievable information.
The fact is that the court didn't allow for to be clarification questions coming from the state, and I think that the court's actions belied what her words were and that it was for impeachment purposes and not for clarification purposes. Her actions were out to get Mr. Carpru and not to clarify his testimony.
Did the jury know that she was out to get Mr. Carpru?
As far as I know, the jury did not know that, no.
I'm going to blend the... This may be a... detour, but I'm going to blend the questioning of the two justices that preceded me. And let's say, to paraphrase some of the stuff that the trial court said, the trial court said, called the attorneys up to the bench and said, hey, the defendant is testifying to things in a way that aren't right, that aren't correct. I'm not saying he's lying, but he's not saying it the way things are. Mr. Prosecutor, are you going to call him? Are you going to call Mara, who knows this stuff? How does that play into the analysis? Do you have enough there to give me an answer whether or not that crosses the line of advocate, from judge to advocate?
I think that that might be a little different. But again, we need to be very circumspect about what we do. Is the judge then going to later on assist the other side in the same manner and say, counsel, I see the jurors, and you can't see them from where you're sitting, and their faces are confused. Maybe you want to call another witness to reiterate some of that information that you provided to the jury? And I guess that's the analogy that I make, is that a judge needs to be very careful about what they do on behalf of one party or the other.
Ms. Rapkin, I'd like to go back to a question that Justice Crooks asked very early on in the State's argument about what is the appropriate legal analysis to apply to what went on here. At one end of the spectrum, we can apply the analysis of a biased judge, due process, and that carries with it a certain legal standard, and if it's met, then it is not subjected to a harmless error analysis because a trial before a biased judge is considered structural error and automatically reversible. Or what went on here could be analyzed as a simple error on the part of the trial court in the way that she questioned the witnesses under the statute, which permits the calling and questioning of witnesses by judges, but it could be argued that this was a violation of that statute and constituted error on the part of the trial court, and that's subjected to a different legal standard. And if it's met and there was error, then harmless error analysis applies. Or at the other end of the spectrum, because that error was not preserved by a timely objection of your predecessor counsel, it's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and that carries a different sort of a legal standard, and if it's met, prejudice has to be proven. So if we could just kind of go through that chronology of legal analyses. And my understanding is that you're banking on the due process argument because then you don't have to prove prejudice or harmless error, right?
Right. This is plain error, and the standard for plain error is, does it affect the fairness, the reputation of the proceedings?
Right. And I want to ask you, what is the legal standard that applies to your due process claim? As I understand it, appearance of bias is not sufficient under the McBride case. You have to show actual bias. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I think that this shows actual bias. I mean, certainly you're never going to have a judge come out and say, I really dislike you, but I'm going to hear this case anyways. You're never going to...
And I don't disagree with you. It's got to be proven circumstantially, and we'd have to draw some inferences. But that, nevertheless, is your legal burden to carry. And I want to know from you and have you marshal all of the facts that you have that are of record. I don't know if it's of record that Judge Schellinger is a former prosecutor. I don't know that it's of record that Paul Tiffin is the head of the sexual assault unit for the district attorney's office. You and I may know that, but I don't know that that's of record. So if you would marshal all of the facts that you have that are of record that you contend establish actual bias on the part of this trial judge.
That she took a very active approach in trying the case on behalf of the prosecutor, that she questioned the medical personnel, the nurse, for 10 or 11 pages, I believe it was, to certify her as an expert witness rather than allowing the prosecutor to ask those questions.
I don't want to interrupt, but was that in your brief that about her? I probably missed it, but I didn't.
No, you didn't miss it. You didn't miss it.
Well, that's not in
part. No, it's not part of the brief. It is part of the record. It's part of the transcripts.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
The transcript is of 35-222, and it begins at page 147, where the trial court then takes over and makes this nurse and certifies her as an expert witness. And the fact that she went and obtained Mr. Morrill and brought him to the courtroom and proceeded to question him.
Is that in the record, counsel?
That is also...
That she went and obtained Mr. Morrill.
Well, somehow he gets into the courtroom and is called by her.
I want to know where it says she went and obtained Mr. Morrill.
Yes. 36-180, page 82, the transcript of August 31st, it appears that she had the bailiff call Mr. Morrill.
Well, the bailiff would call, I mean, the counsel, I've been I was a former trial judge for 14 years before I came here, and I always have, I don't, as a trial judge, I don't say, the witness come up, I have a bailiff, would you call, and the person is either in the courtroom, that's what I asked, or in an adjacent room. That is how, that's normal practice, isn't it?
Not necessarily in Milwaukee, or at least
to get a witness up to the...
Yeah, but it's her witness, that's your point. It's the judge calling her witness.
Correct. No, and my understanding is she had the bailiff...
I guess what bothers me is when a judge under 90614 can call a witness, how else would the judge call a witness but to have the bailiff do it?
No other way. But the point being that she took this active involvement to do that, to call the witness. And then the third element is her obtaining from the clerk's office the defendant's previous criminal file and looking through that file and looking for something, I don't know why she did that or what she was doing it for, finding a letter that he had written to a previous trial judge, reading that letter, and then taking it and using that to embarrass him, to impeach him, to provide the state again with some grounds for attacking his credibility. I mean, there was no other reason to do that at that point in time.
And just to follow up on the other two legal analyses that might arguably apply here, if this is analyzed as error by the trial judge, the legal standard that applies to that, as I understand it, requires us to conclude that her questioning had some improper influence on the jury. Would you agree with that as the applicable legal standard?
Well, I think the applicable legal standard is that the burden is on the prosecutor to show beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't affect the jury or the outcome of the jury.
Well, that's the harmless error analysis, and I agree with you on that. But in terms of the legal standard in the case law for analyzing when a judge oversteps his or her bounds in questioning a witness under the statute, as I read S4 and all the other Wisconsin cases, it does require that questioning have some improper influence on the jury, and then it's analyzed for harmless error after that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And because this didn't occur in front of the jury, you can't succeed on that analysis, right?
Well, other cases have said something different.
But analyzed under
Wisconsin law. Under Wisconsin law, correct.
All right. That's fine. And then the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you concede that you have to show prejudice and that's your burden?
I guess I would argue that I don't have to show prejudice, that this is automatically prejudicial in the same way that this court has found prejudice in other cases, such as Erickson, where this court has stated that prejudice is presumed when certain actions happen that eviscerate trial counsel's ability to proceed in a effective manner. So that's what I would be asking this court is to find prejudice automatically. My time is up.
Thank you, Ms.
Justice Presser is going to make me go.
Your opposing counsel, I think, commented at one point, what objection would counsel have made when the judge called Mr. Morrow to testify? He said, I don't know what objection counsel would have made. What objection would you have made or should have been made?
I think that the question should have been, Judge, why are you calling him? What's the purpose? And hear what the judge was going to do and then be able to make an objection and say, no, Judge, that's, you know, if you're doing this to provide information to the prosecutor, that this is completely and totally inappropriate. You have no right to do that.
Well, it would seem to me that the objection should be, Judge, I think you're trying this case, and I object before I would let Morrow say a word. Your goal is not to tip the state.
Right. That's correct.
We don't want, or maybe we do want the judge to make an offer of her proof.
Perhaps. But this case has important ramifications, not just for Johnny Coprue and for the criminal trials, but for all trials, and whether it's a civil or a criminal trial and how far a judge can go. Am I excused?
Thank you, Mr. Rapkin. Assistant Attorney General Lee.
Are you going to answer the question, how far a judge can go? That's what I'd like to ask you, Counsel.
How far a judge can go? I think the actual test is whether there is actual prejudice under McBride and Sinks. That is the test in Wisconsin for, excuse me, lack of partiality, lack of impartiality or bias. I think Justice Sykes' question shows that there's still great confusion here, and certainly on my part also, exactly what Carpru is arguing. If we are arguing here that the judge was not impartial, that is McBride and the Sinks analysis, cases that are not discussed by the Court of Appeals or the defense. And the test there is actual prejudice. And by
preponderance. Is that a finding of fact, Counselor, or is that a conclusion of law based on the record?
That is a de novo review by the appellate court. But the defense has to show it by a preponderance of the evidence. And it must be actual prejudice, not perceived. And you look at the Court of Appeals decision, paragraph 11 says the judge's actions, quote, suggested favoritism. Paragraph 16, the appearance that she was partial. That's not the test. Now, if the actual argument is that the judge was a, quote, hinting advocate, there the question is, was the fact finder, the jury, improperly influenced? And I think we can all agree that that would be impossible because the jury didn't have any idea what the judge had done outside of the jury's presence. Taking a very different hypothetical, what if we have a trial, civil or criminal, where both parties testify that a certain street was a one-way street? And everybody seems to agree, and the judge goes, wait, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's a one-way street at all. And the jury is going to be very confused by that if I'm right and everybody else here is wrong. Is the judge supposed to let the testimony that he or she perceives to be inaccurate go to the jury? Or is it the judge's duty to find out exactly what the facts are and let the jury decide the case on the accurate facts?
Could you take judicial notice of a map that shows it a one-way street?
I suppose they could, but if they had actually testified, and it might even be important to one side or the other, whether they thought it was a one-way street. And that might be the issue. But the point is that what's important here is the judge's ability to get accurate information to the jury, even if the parties themselves may not be very sure what the accurate information is. The judge shouldn't be bound totally by the strategy or ineptitude of the defense or the prosecution.
How do you decide if the judge is doing it for clarification or for impeachment? Seldom do we have any witness like Perry Mason used to have say, oh, I'm lying. Instead, the hallmark of cross-examination is to get the witness to reveal inconsistencies or how do you define motivation and discern motivation, whether the questions are asked indeed for clarification as opposed to arrive at inconsistencies, which of course then undermines the credibility?
Well, I think there's, depending on the facts, not much difference between straightening out the facts and straightening out an inconsistency that might affect the defendant's credibility.
I see that differently. I mean, well, that's what I'm trying to do when I'm cross-examining, is to get inconsistencies. Since I'm not going to get them to admit that they're lying, I'm going to show that what they're saying is inconsistent with what other witnesses have said, what they have said previously, mm-hmm. under oath, in other situations, what difference than what their statement said. I mean, that's how you do it.
This is slightly different, because this wasn't the question of what Carpru thought. The judge was saying, maybe Carpru thought that's why they were coming to get him. What I'm interested in doing here is straightening out what in-house correctional services actually does. That's a different issue, I think. And I would point out, when the judge was done questioning Carpru, both the prosecution and the both the prosecution and the defense had an opportunity to cross-examine him. The defense did. When Morrow was called to the stand by the prosecution, the defense cross-examined Morrow and pointed out, for example, that there's a good possibility that the people in this program wouldn't know all of the rules as clearly as the program would like them to know the rules. Hardly surprising to any of us. And as I pointed out, a very small part of the trial on why he ran down the stairs, through the basement, into the window, and under the porch.
The grandmother's house.
I would also point out, Justice Wilcox asked a question about whether Morrow was there. Record 36, page 81, at the top says, I thought Mr. Morrow told me before you folks had already seen it. That was the file from in-house correctional services, unless we're talking about the exhibit. That's what leads me to conclude that Mr. Morrow had been there somehow talking to the both sides and the judge. I would only point out in closing that under the defense theory, a judge really can't question any witness because the questions might help one side or the other. It is possible when Judge Schellinger questioned Mr. Morrow that his answers would have helped Mr. Carpru. She didn't know that. I think the record's quite clear that she and both counsel didn't quite know what correctional services did. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee, and thank you, Ms. Rapkin, for your interesting arguments this morning. That closes our hearing on 02-2781 CR, State versus Carpru. And we are going to take a few moments recess so that the students may leave and new students may come in.